Well, hi, everybody, and welcome back to a special Christmas edition of the Flicks the Church Forgot. My name is Peter Laws, and if you want to get in touch with me, you can follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws or email me at contactus@theflicksthechurchforgot.com. Or why not go crazy and follow the Facebook page at the Flicks the Church Forgot? But now, with that preamble out of the way, why don't you come on in? You do look a bit freezing. Yeah, come on. You take off your jacket. Great. Okay, I'll just hang on. Yeah, grab that seat. By the fire. Brandy? Wonderful. Oh, thanks. Yeah, it is a pretty nice Christmas tree, isn't it? Thanks. I chopped that down myself, would you believe? Yeah, over up on Parsons Hill. What? Yes, that is the hill they used to hang the witches on, but I haven't told the children that, obviously. I don't want them freaking out at some Christmas tree that had a swinging witch from it back in the 17th century, do I? Ho, ho. Anyway, come on in. Yeah, sit by this fire. You can get warm. Wonderful. Here's your drink. Anyway, look, I'm really glad you had the time to come over. And yes, I still was hoping to chat to you about, well, about ghosts. Are you well prepared for Christmas? I know that you're such an organized person, you probably have the eggnog on order. I bet you've already sent a note of execution to the turkey, but bought your ironic and retro woolly jumper yet? You have? Thought as much. But listen, I wanted to check with you about something really quite important. I just wanted to know if you'd sorted out your ghost stories for Christmas yet. I mean, you and I both know that Christmas without ghosts is like Kit without a turbo boost. Oh yes, of course. The hub of Christmas is Jesus, I'm sure we'll get to that, but interesting, isn't it, how ghosts seem just so appropriate this time of year? We'll explore why maybe a bit later, but for now, let me tell you that the British Film Institute have recently released a whole slew of horror DVDs that quite frankly are going to do a wonderful job of providing that essential metaphysical component for the festive period. In fact, it's a bulging sack full of TV dramas from 1970s BBC. So I thought I'd chat to you about that tonight, is that all right? But before we get to them, let me tell you a little bit about the BFI, the British Film Institute. The British Film Institute, or the BFI, is a charity that was formed in 1933, and the idea of it is to promote film and television as an important method of recording life and culture. But also, it's there to care and look after and preserve films and television programs that might otherwise end up forgotten. Now, as well as releasing books and DVDs, they also have a couple of cinemas in London on the South Bank, and one of which is called is the IMAX Theatre, but the other one is called BFI South Bank, and that site really is the hub of all of its activity. And I must say, it's a really great place to visit if you're ever in London. I was there quite recently. I had a meeting early on in Covent Garden area, and once the meeting was done, I headed off down to the BFI for a look around, not least because at the moment they currently have a season of events and releases all related to British Gothic. And before we dive into some of the DVD releases of the 1970s ghost stories, which are part of that festival, as it were, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the items that they have on display down at the BFI, which I recently saw. For example, they have a whole section dedicated to the fantastic haunted house movie, The Innocents. I did a podcast episode of that quite a while back. But anyway, you can see the original art concepts for the film there, as well as three sheets of genuine handwritten notes by Truman Capote, who co-wrote the script. And it's fascinating to see his actual handwriting, which does look almost like a child's. And written there is his introduction of like a whispering montage scene in that very spooky movie. But then anyway, on the mezzanine floor at the BFI, there's a few other exhibits that really got my attention. Sitting under a glass case as some oblivious people just seem to mill about were the actual contracts for Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee for their work on Curse of Frankenstein from, I think it's the 50s. I noticed that Christopher Lee got paid £50 a day, whereas Cushing, the pay section for him seemed to be blanked out. I'm not sure what that was all about. I suspect that at that point, Cushing maybe got paid more, or a set fee or something like that, who knows. But anyway, along from that section was a little cabinet devoted to Vincent Price's classic schlock horror, Theatre of Blood, from the 70s. And there was a press book there and a series of colour charts that were used to determine the colour scheme of the movie. Schlock horror, it was mostly shades of red. But then, just sitting there, is an actual handwritten note from Vincent Price sent to George Blackler. Now, he was the makeup artist on the film, as well as various other horror films. Blackler actually is even an uncredited makeup artist on the very creepy Powell and Pressburger film Black Narcissus from 1947, which has some of the simplest yet scariest makeup I've ever seen. Basically, the mad woman at the end with her sunken eyes, pale skin, and wet, straggled hair still gives me the creeps today. But anyway, this letter is from Vincent Price thanking Blackler for all his hard work on Theatre of Blood, and for the sake of fanboy completism, the letter read thus. Dear George, I came back to see you at the final Holocaust in the theatre, but you'd gone. Already, I miss you. What a joy it was to work with you again, as pleasant as Swaffern, and I look forward to another soon. I must begin to say how much I appreciate your creativity with all the kooky characters I had to play and your generosity in letting me have my way with some of the far-out ideas. At least it's... And that's where the paper ends, basically. Sorry I can't do the Vincent Price accent. That would be embarrassing. But alas, I couldn't break into the cabinet and turn it over and read the rest. But I share that because it's just a very pleasant-sounding, gracious man as Vincent Price. And you often hear this, that those who work in horror are some of the nicest people in Hollywood. And I don't know, I just felt that little glimpse seems like a good example of just decent people being friendly to one another within this creative world of scariness and gore. I once drove past Vincent Price's old house in Beverly Hills, which was really fun to see that. But seeing this little letter from him give me a bit of an insight into his character. It's funny to think of the horror stars that we love that have this background of thankfulness and joy at being involved in that genre. You know, some people tend to look down on horror, like actors, and people might see it as not a serious or important genre and they want to move on to more serious films, but I really like Price's enthusiasm for it. Apparently, Theatre of Blood was a personal favourite of his. And anyway, then along from this little cabinet was a genuine British horror icon. Just standing there in this glass case was the actual cape and costume from Christopher Lee wearing it in Dracula from 1958. That's the one also known as the Horror of Dracula. And the cape's like in really good condition, maybe a little smaller than I expected given Christopher Lee's towering look in the film. But still, it gives an appropriate geeky shiver when I stared at it. It's weird, isn't it? How certain things just thrill certain people. Some people might get excited over seeing David Beckham's football boot or Princess Diana's wedding dress or, you know, Henry VIII's goblet. But for me, it's a handwritten letter from Vincent Price in Count Dracula's actual cape that reminds me that at heart, I suppose I will always be a monster kid, as I know you are. So anyway, as part of this gothic season, the BFI have not only got these little exhibits, but they have also released a whole bunch of horror DVDs, and they recently sent me a great little pile of almost about £100 worth of paranormal goodness. And so, let me share some thoughts on these creepy new releases. We start with Dead of Night from 1972. Now, first off, it's really easy to get mixed up on this title, as there are a few other horror films that share this same name. There's a film from 1972 about a killed Vietnam soldier who returns as a zombie. That's also known as Death Dream, but it's also known as Dead of Night. Then there's the British anthology horror from 1945, which has a rather creepy segment about a ventriloquist's dummy. Apparently someone involved in that movie, Dead of Night, from 45, was not impressed and wrote to the BBC when they nicked this title for this BBC show that I'm about to talk about. But then, perhaps most confusing, is that there is another TV-based anthology movie from the 70s called Dead of Night, which came from Dan Curtis, and maybe American audiences would think of that primarily with this title. That was the TV film that had the story at the end called Bobby, of a distraught mother trying to cope with the loss of her drowned son. That segment caused many kids nightmares back in the day. It's a really good segment, the best one, in my opinion, and most other people's opinion, too. But Dead of Night from 1972 BBC is an anthology series which originally consisted of 7 episodes. Sadly, 4 of those episodes are now lost. I mean, can you imagine that? All of that hard work recorded and televised, and then some dumbass at the BBC probably used it, like wiped the tapes to make space for Match of the Day or something. But anyway, some scripts and stills still survive, and they can be accessed through this DVD, which is a cool little extra. But let me talk you through the episodes that did make it and survive today, and they all are present, all 3 of them, on this release. Return Flight is a really slow-moving tale of a commercial pilot who starts seeing visions of World War II. Now, I started with this one because I think it's the weakest of the bunch, and I did find my mind wandering during it because the pace of it moves at a real crawl. And I'm not sure, but I just don't seem to find World War II ghosts as scary as Victorian or 16th century ghosts and spooks. I don't know, it's weird to discover that you can have actual subtastes in this already kooky, bizarre subject, but having said that, it does have a pretty chilling ending, though really, I can't imagine me ever watching this episode again. But let me talk about the other two episodes, because I think they're much more interesting. The third one is called A Woman Sobbing, and that is far more interesting to me, at least, not least because it's more creepy, but also because it's got a lot more sociological subtext, which I always tend to get a kick out of in films. Like this particular episode, it explores sex and loneliness and the plight of the domestic housewife. And it's an oppressive and pretty unforgiving story, actually. In fact, I'd say that of all three of these surviving tales from the series, they aren't afraid to go dark and keep things dark. In A Woman Sobbing, Anna Massey plays this headstrong wife who is tormented by the sound of a woman sobbing in her attic. And nobody else seems to hear it apart from her. You can imagine how creepy that would be in the middle of the night, and how mad it would be when nobody else could hear it either. You may remember Massey from films like Peeping Tom and Hitchcock's Frenzy. Now, she's one of those actresses with a very distinctive look. She's certainly not a classic beauty, but she has this prettiness about her in a very geeky, slightly, you know, unusual way. And I think she's cool. I like her. And I don't know, she just looks an interesting person. But she plays the part of an unhappy housewife in this, and she plays it brilliantly. Her husband tries to be understanding, but he can't hear the things that she does, and he just figures, oh, it's just women going through their weirdness. And as her life grows gradually more intolerable, you really get this sense of sorrow for what she is going through and the loneliness it must be like. And this story, it could be as much about mental illness and depression as it is about woman's oppression. But it's certainly about woman's oppression, I felt. At one point, for example, her advertising executive husband is sitting, sipping wine, and he's pondering some new tagline at home for a campaign. And she's sitting there opposite him, and she asks, you know, why don't you ever ask me for ideas? And he says something like, you know, you're just demographically insignificant, my dear. And she just sort of shrugs and moves on like it's a, yeah, okay. Bit cheeky, but it's not offensive. It's a very cutting and telling remark, and this whole idea is indicative of a decade where women were getting just about sick of being told they were only useful for one thing, but there were plenty of people around who actually would reinforce that idea. The Stepford Wives, that's a favourite of mine, came out a couple of years after this, but Dead of Night explores many of the same themes, as does Shalkin the Painter, which we're going to come to in a little bit. Anyway, for its central performance by Massey and its chilling ending and the heartbreaking core of the themes, I really enjoyed A Woman Sobbing. But like many of these BFI things, you need to have patience watching it because they're fairly slow moving, but I still quite like that. Coming to the final episode on this disc, which is actually the first one on the disc, is something called, slightly confusingly in my opinion, The Exorcism. Now, this is probably the standout segment of this whole set, where two posh couples sip wine and discuss politics in this plush country home. And one of the couples have just bought this home as a second property, you know, the classic city folk moving into the countryside to buy up land and property. And their chatter and interests really do personify the upper middle class in the UK of the time. I want to be a socialist, one of them says, but a rich one. But gradually, things at this dinner party as they're chatting together starts to go very strange. The wine that they're enjoying starts to taste like blood, and the darkness outside grows ever darker to a point of being pitch blackness. What I love about these old BBC dramas is that they are so indicative of an urge to be rational thinkers. So when the strange things occur, the characters don't freak out or get scared or think, oh my word, this place is haunted. They just insist on calmly coming up with clever academic theories of what might be happening. It's a mass hallucination. It's hysteria. You know, again, like TV shows from the BBC, like The Stone Tape, which is really creepy and brilliant. But again, it's like there must be rational reasons for these happening. We can all explain this by science. But heaven forfend, could this be the paranormal, the spiritual? You know, they don't tend to go to that very quickly. Now, the setting and story itself is very claustrophobic and increasingly so, where this wonderful country escape starts to ironically feel like the exact opposite. But what is most unsettling about The Exorcism is the performance of Sylvia Kay. Now, she plays one of the wives who develop, before anyone else, a sense of what is really going on at the cottage. But her acting, man, it's like it really makes your flesh creep. But she has this substantial, tear-filled monologue with very few cuts, which is just a tour de force of acting. And she's got some very heartbreaking lines in that section. The ending is also clever, as it is bleak. And after The Exorcism, I just found it to be a heady mix of politics and socialism and the paranormal, which will leave you a little moved and a little disturbed and thought-provoked, if that's the right word. So that's the Dead of Night disc. One, for me, forgettable episode, but two really interesting ones. Listen, I think it's probably time to have a little break, and we'll come back and share a little more about this. Let's go and stretch our legs for a bit. So, this is the end of part one. You can tune back in for part two, and we'll continue our look at the BFI Gothic BBC Ghost Stories, and we'll start digging into the depths of what ghosts might mean in a world where God exists, or indeed doesn't exist.